On This Week in Enterprise Tech, it's our predictions for the first half of 2017. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 226, recorded February 3rd, 2017, for February 10th, 2017. Predictions 2017, first half. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Amazon Web Services. For companies to succeed today, they need a range of tools that most cloud vendors just don't offer. Amazon Web Services, the leading cloud service provider, listens to builders, offering more solutions than any other cloud provider. Check out podcast.aws and see how AWS lets builders build. And by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. To learn more about GoCD, visit gocd.io/twit for a free download. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Palliser, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And we've got a special treat for you. It's all hands on deck for our predictions episode. Now, I know we normally do this at the end of every year, but because we had so many good guests brought to us by our fantastic producer, Chibert, we kind of pushed it, and now it's in February. But yet, we do need to take a look at our predictions from 2016 and take a look ahead at 2017. And that means we've got everybody, starting with, of course, our super producer, Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, and it's nice to be on the show.
Yeah, of course, and it's nice to have you there. And we've also got Mr. Curtis Franklin. He is, I'm going to say he is our statesman of all things that are mature and enterprise. Curtis, how are things? Now, you know, every time I see you in this room, it just feels wrong because I expect to see you against a window. But you've had this set for a while now. Tell me, how is 2017 treating you?
So far, 2017 has been great. It's been busy, lots of new and exciting things on tap, and just happy to stop for a moment and enjoy the peace, quiet, and tranquility of another episode of Twyatt.
Speaking of peace, quiet, and tranquility, there is no combination of that quite like the third co-host that we added to our repertoire. That's right. It's Mr. Lou Maresca from Microsoft. Lou, I mean, again, dang, I don't know how you do it with the hair, but it's a win every time.
I try. I do this for the show. So I'm all excited about this show, especially for the predictions coming up.
This is. And it was the prediction show in 2016 when we officially welcomed you into the Twyatt crew to become part of our co-host rotation. So it's even though we're at the wrong date, it is nice to have this first anniversary, Lou. You've been a great asset to the Twyatt, right?
Love being here. Thanks, guys.
Now, gentlemen, we're going to get to the predictions, but at first, as we always do, we have to start with the blips. And the winner of the most dependable enterprise drive is, you know, once a year, Backblaze, the cloud storage provider, gives us a glimpse into their data centers in the form of reliability numbers. Well, with tens of thousands of drives running in their racks and units of all manufacturers and capacities running in the same environment, their numbers provide some real-world data on performance and reliability. The actual data provided by Backblaze takes up close to 6.5 gigs, so here are just a few highlights. 2016 saw the lowest failure rate Backblaze has ever had at 1.95%. The smallest drives they still use are 3 terabytes, which should be swapped out this year. They're seeing excellent reliability in 8 terabyte drives across the board, with Seagate 6 and 8 terabyte units outperforming average longevity, even as one model of the same 4 terabyte units had a 13.6% failure rate. The most improved award goes to Toshiba, which saw a huge improvement over last year's numbers, with their units reaching over 1.2 million aggregated hours without failure versus their rated 1 million hours. But the winner has to be both Toshiba's 4-terabyte and HGST's 8-terabyte drives. Backblaze had a 45-drive pod filled with HGST 8-terabyte units and three 45-drive pods filled with Toshiba 4-terabyte units. All of those pods went a full year without a single spindle failure. That's 180 years of aggregate use with 0% failure.
Especially since it's my anniversary, and I wanted a bit of synergy between last year, my predictions last year, and what's being reported this year. Remember Tesla? Elon Musk, you know, the guy who's building the fully clean and sustainable gigafactory where Tesla will come from, well, the new Teslas will come from. Well, 200 miles from there sits the Chemetall foot limit light lithium plant, the largest lithium producer in North America, together makes up the foundation of Tesla's energy empire. I need some Imperial March going on here if you got any of that. Along with the factory and the batteries comes Tesla's Semi, a heavy-duty autonomous cargo truck, which is currently under development. The production of this new truck is planned the same time as the Gigafactory goes online around 2020. Guys, did we have any money riding on those predictions?
Hey, the cloud, well, it just keeps on growing, and AWS is still the biggest cloud of all. Amazon's ferocious cloud growth slowed just a bit in the final quarter of 2016, but during the fourth quarter, AWS accounted for 40% of the global public cloud market, according to numbers released on Thursday by Synergy Research Group. Now, that's the same market share that it had at the end of 2015, but let's put the numbers in perspective. Microsoft, Google, and IBM collectively increased their share of the public cloud market by about 5%, and when combined, these three companies represent about 23% of the public cloud space. Altogether, the report shows how dominant AWS has become and how far behind the competition is in this growing market. AWS reported net sales of $3.5 billion during its fiscal fourth quarter, a 47% year-over-year increase. Annual sales totaled $12.2 billion, a 55% increase from 2015. Now, during the fourth quarter, Synergy estimated that public cloud services in total pulled in about $7 billion in revenue, which represented a 50% year-over-year increase. When managed private cloud is added into the mix, that number jumps to more than $9 billion. While Microsoft, Google, and IBM made the most gains in the public cloud, these three vendors increased their share at the expense of smaller cloud players and not the giant AWS.
AT&T is starting trials on a multi-gigabit wireless system that uses power lines for guides. AT&T is saying that it's in talks with power companies to start trials of a new broadband technology that has pole-top transceivers and use the power lines like waveguides, with goals of providing power companies with new carrier capabilities for smart meters, but also home and cellular services possible in the future. This may be an answer, especially for rural areas where current broadband doesn't even qualify to be called that under the last administration's FCC rules.
Hey, are you still using the desktop you had back in 1993? No, probably not. Not only would it be hopelessly outdated, but hardware spanning more than two decades and four presidents could hardly be expected to keep working. Unless, of course, that hardware serves a steel business, has a great admin, and runs one of the most stable operating systems in history. Phil Hogan, an IT applications architect, has been nursing a Stratus Technologies fault-tolerant server since 1993. In 24 years of operation, Hogan has replaced about 20% of the components as they age, but the redundant subsystems have never had an unplanned shutdown. Running Stratus Voss, which was last updated in the early 2000s, Hogan's server has been powering Great Lakes Works, a steel company in Dearborn, Michigan, since its power-up during the Clinton administration. Alas, all good things come to an end. Now that Great Lakes has become part of U.S. Steel, the trusty Stratus will be retired in April. Still, for those of us who have had to nurse hopelessly outdated systems because of budget constraints, resource policies, or simply because our old software doesn't run on new hardware, an IT salute is due to Hogan for a job well done.
What were Isaac Asimov's three laws of robotics back in 1942? I think they were: a robot may not harm a human or allow a human to be harmed, a robot must obey a human's orders unless it conflicts with the first law, and a robot must protect itself unless it violates the first two laws. Well,
Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, and hundreds of other researchers, scientists, tech leaders around the world have now endorsed their own version called the 23 Guiding Principles for AI. Are 23 enough? Nope. They claim it's by no means a comprehensive list. Yet, are there similarities to Asimov's way of thinking? Absolutely. Like principle number 11, human values, AI systems should be designed and operated so that it's compatible with humans' dignity, rights, compatible with their culture and diversity and freedoms. I personally like law number 22, recursive self-improvement. Systems designated to recursively self-improve or self-replicate in a manner that could lead to rapidly increasing quality or quantity must be subject to strict safety and control measures. Hey, as long as the principles don't actually lead us to Skynet, I'm all for a bit of structure in this area of innovation.
Psst, want to hear a rumor? Verizon is getting ready to sell its cloud. Light Reading, which in full disclosure is my day job, is reporting that less than 2 months after announcing the sale of its data centers in a $3.6 billion deal with Equinix, Verizon is on the verge of divesting itself of its broader enterprise cloud services business. While there's no official confirmation, Verizon declined to comment for the story, a trusted source with knowledge of the deal told Light Reading that a sale had been agreed upon and that a public announcement is expected to be made in February or March. The telco lost out in the race for market share in public cloud services to Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. Verizon bought cloud services company Terramark in 2011, but despite the competitive advantage that deal was supposed to deliver, Verizon was never able to build on Terramark's success. AT&T, CenturyLink, and Windstream Communications all continue to sell enterprise services. However, Windstream has sold off its physical data centers, and CenturyLink is in the process of doing the same. The focus for all three of those operators, and now Verizon, is rapidly shifting toward virtualization and away from physical assets.
Well, the Tennessee governor wants to let electric co-ops offer broadband, but only within their service areas. I, for one, am a bit surprised that Tennessee is trying this with the current FCC, but this proposed ruling would allow electric co-ops to provide broadband, but only within the co-op service area. Nothing outside, which would limit larger cities like Chattanooga from providing coverage for neighboring townships. I should point out that many power companies already tend to run optical fiber bonded to high voltage lines to make use of their existing rights of way. The drawback has been the public utility commissions and the FCC standing in the way. Only time will tell whether the new FCC director, Ajit Pai, will let this happen. I have a suspicion that a whole lot of cities are watching to see if Tennessee succeeds.
Hey, I'm going to let you into a little secret that's not so secret. We like mobile devices, and that means that we like batteries. We like power. From consumer to enterprise-level gear, portable energy keeps us connected, computing, and processing. But as we've seen in several high-profile cases, high-density energy storage in affordable, portable, and non-explodey packages isn't easy to come by. There have been several promising technologies introduced over the years, from supercapacitors to titanium oxide carbon nanotube-boosted lithium, but most of them are still in the concept stage and not ready to scale. Now it's time to add one that could be into production almost immediately. Mike Zimmerman, a professor at Tufts University and the founder of Ionic Materials, has come up with a novel approach to lithium-ion energy storage. It uses the same main components of traditional lithium-poly batteries, which means it's easy to manufacture. That includes a cathode and an anode. But it replaces the sensitive and potentially unstable lithium electrolyte with a plastic film. With no chemical witch's brew, the pack can't have a runaway reaction, even if it's breached, cut, crushed, or set on fire. Furthermore, since Zimmerman's batteries use lithium metal instead of a lithium solution, they can store twice as much power even as they greatly increase the durability of the energy storage. There's plenty of testing to be done with this new technology, but unlike many exotic material concepts, his tech works and scales now. Perhaps the first step to the Internet of Things that won't go on fire. That does it for the blips. Next up, we're going to be jumping into our predictions. But first, let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by AWS, Amazon Web Services. You know them, you love them, you know what they do. They help you to build what you want to build rather than worrying about infrastructure. AWS provides a robust and scalable platform to help builders of all sizes and all types innovate quickly, with twice the compliance certifications and the largest global footprint of any other cloud vendor. AWS does all the heavy lifting of the IT infrastructure management. So builders like you can focus on what you do best, which is to design solutions, not build out networks. AWS provides the most comprehensive set of features for builders, releasing new features at a faster rate than anybody else, with over 1,000 new features in 2016 alone. Now, their services support virtually any cloud workload with more than 70 services that range from compute, storage, networking, database, analytics, application services, deployment management, and mobile. By listening to what builders want, AWS has been adding the capabilities that you actually want to see. AWS storage solutions are designed to deliver secured, scalable, and durable storage for businesses looking to achieve efficiency and scalability within their backup and recovery environments without the need for an on-premise infrastructure. AWS offers the widest global reach of any cloud provider and allows you to choose in which region your data resides to minimize latency and costs, as well as address regulatory requirements. You know what I'm talking about. You have complete control of your data. In other words, someone else may be holding it for you, but you decide where it goes and where it's used. With AWS, startups can scale like enterprises, and enterprises can be nimble like startups. If you are looking at a new project, if you do not want to build out your own infrastructure, if you want to be agile and nimble, then you need to try AWS. Whether you're new to AWS or have experience, they want to provide the right resources to support your success and help you do amazing things. Learn more at podcast.aws. That's podcast.aws. And we thank Amazon Web Services for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Gentlemen, 2016 was interesting, and we had a bunch of predictions from 2015 that, we need to take a look at before we jump into our predictions for 2017. Now, first, we should note that if you remember, our 2015 into 2016 episode was kind of weird. Our production got stopped halfway through, so we kind of had to pick up later on. It's a little weird, but we did write down everything that we said we thought was going to happen, and now we need to run through it. Chibert, do you want to start with your short-term prognostication? What exactly did you suggest was going to happen within 6 months?
I'm basically saying that the Internet of Things will go beyond media hype and what a lot of people were calling a fizzle and go into starting to appear. And one of my big things is that we're going to start seeing Google, AWS, and Microsoft moving into the space and see some specialty clouds. But most importantly, I was saying that the mobile virtual network operators were going to start reaching the enterprise, and that's an Arduino Micro with a 3G modem on an MVNO. So that's a real product shipping and in my hand.
Right, right. And actually, I will support you with that, because as I've gone out to CES, Maker Faire, all these places where hardware vendors are bringing out their devices, they've all got something IoT enabled. They've all got something that's designed to be sensing in the real world and to send data back to a cloud where it could be run through a big data analytics engine like Hadoop. Now, the predictions were kind of weird, though. When we looked at it last year, of course, Brian, you thought that this was going to happen within 6 months. Curtis said it was going to happen within 6 months. Lou agreed that it was going to happen within 6 months. I said nay. And the reason why I said nay was because the security concerns will keep it from happening in the first half of 2016, which was what the short-term predictions was about. I don't know if you've got me sold on that. I see it now, and I definitely saw it at the end of the year. But at the end of June, there were still so many devices that were getting owned that IoT was a mess. I don't know. Curtis, what do you think? Do we give this one to Chibert? Did he get it in the first 6 months?
Well, I think that the two things that you're saying aren't mutually exclusive, because I think that he was right in what was happening in the first 6 months. And I think you're also right in that it was a mess and a lot of devices were getting owned. I mean, we saw that later in the year with some of the massive DDoS attacks that happened, fueled largely by traffic coming off of owned IoT devices. So, I think that in betting parlance, maybe we call this a push, because both of you ended up being on the right side of history.
I don't know. I don't like pushes. Pushes always go to the dealer. And we've got one man on our crew who actually has the looks to be a dealer. Lou, I don't know why I said that. I was thinking like a dealer in Vegas. I just realized that actually has another meaning. But okay, but never mind. Lou, Lou, what do you think? I mean, I understand where Curtis is trying to place this. Yeah, it is. Actually, it's still a mess. You know, the Internet of Things.
It's a mess. Yeah.
It is. It's the Internet of Own Things. But do you think that within the first 6 months of 2016, we saw enough of that push to say, yeah, this is happening now?
I'm going to say no. I mean, I think Curtis has brought up a good point. I think, you know, because of the own devices, I think that was a deterrent for companies to do that. I think, you know, you could almost see traffic, you know, in some of these services like AWS that handles IoT devices, Azure, so on and so forth. You know, there might be an increased amount of traffic, but it definitely has plateaued. So I think that at some, you know, it's not on the as much going up as much as we expected. So I think that they're, you know, the next generation, I'd call them almost V2 of IoT, are on their way. You know, lower power, you know, more secured devices. But I would say that at this point, I don't think that they had adopted as much as we had hoped.
Okay, and actually, with you saying that, it is kind of a push. You know, this is one of those weird things. T-Bird, I think you were absolutely spot on to bring this up. I think maybe the time frame might shift back and forth. You might say yes or no about the 6 months or so, but you're right. You're absolutely right that this is going to be the end result. Now, the only question is, are they going to work on the security so that it's not such a quagmire of exploits and potential owned devices? Does that sound fair? I mean, I want to give it to you, but I don't think you hit the 6 months.
Yeah, I don't think I did either, and mostly because of security. You're yeah. totally right on that. The IoT world is scrambling to meet it, but I think there's going to be a V2 IoT, and I think it's happening this year. And the big push is going to be how to get away from the Internet of insecure things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was the lone no vote on that prediction, and Chiefert was the lone no vote on the next prediction, which was mine. And my short term, again, that means within the first 6 months of 2016, was that OS protection would go the way of perimeter security. Now, we've talked about this. Actually, we just had a guest on 2 weeks ago talking about how we've given up on trying to put walls around our networks, and we just assume that the attackers are going to be within the walls, and you have to defend individual nodes, and you even have to defend individual PCs, individual OSs, and individual applications. Now, here's what was happening. Last year, that means 2015, we saw the death of perimeter security. Now, it's because we had to assume that the bad guys were within the walls, we saw more and more security companies who were offering tools that could look at actions and patterns within the network to determine even if an authenticated user had been compromised. In other words, we needed to protect those individual nodes. In the first 6 months of the year, this is what I said, this was my prediction, we will see containerization start to take it a step further now that we don't even trust the node. We will protect individual applications and services from other applications and services on the same node. Now, I think we're there. The fact that we had a guest on two weeks ago who we all agreed with says that we are at this point, but I'm in the same boat as Chiebert. I don't know if I hit the 6 months. At the Black Hat and DEF CON stage of the year, there were a couple of vendors who were talking about rolling out their products, but I don't know if I hit the 6 months. Lou, what do you think? Oh, muted.
I think you're definitely right. I think you were a little bit off. I think we started seeing a little bit at the year end around the September and October timeframe to pick up and adapt. And I think that, you know, in the beginning of the year, we didn't see as much as we'd hoped. So I think you're right. I think you weren't the first 6 months, but I would give it to you since you're kind of the edge of the second part of the year.
Right. It was more of a midterm that rather than a short term. Curtis, right. What about you? 6 months, yes or no?
Yeah, I tend to think you're right. You got the totality, but the timing was off. We're starting to see some actual products out there now that do use containerization. But these, as far as I know, the real products in GA didn't happen until the second half of 2016, and they're still rolling around. So I tend to, while I would love to give this one to you, I think the timing works against you.
I think so, too. I think I'm actually with that. Chiebert, would you agree? I think because, I mean, at the Intel Developer Forum, there were at least three companies who offered solutions where they were using containers to open up applications and then immediately destroy them. And the whole idea was it doesn't matter if your network's owned. They're not going to get anything out of these instances.
Yeah.
I'm thinking timing, definitely.
It's timing.
I'm seeing people doing containers, but I don't see containers of getting as mainstream as I thought they were going to.
That is kind of weird, right? Because towards the end of 2015, it felt as if VMs are doomed. VMs are absolutely going away. Containers are the future. And yet they've come back, and they've come back in a big way. Now people actually can say that VMs and containers are going to coexist without it kind of chuckling and saying maybe. What's the general consensus among the group? Are we going to see VMs and containers continue to exist side by side? And do we now know where each one is the good use case?
I think so. I think you're going to start seeing it more and more in the data centers for sure.
Yeah, especially with VMware having containers natively now, and also Server 2016 hypervisor having containers natively. I think that's going to be the big issue.
And I think you hit it exactly right. People are going to be looking at it on an implementation and case-by-case basis. There will be some cases where people say this is obviously a container-specific best fit. There are others where full VMs are going to be the way to go.
Yeah. And to be honest, that wasn't really that much of a stretch, because that was basically me saying it's not a magic bullet. And of course, we know there are no magic bullets. Let's go to the next one. Curtis, you had a short term based on IoT analysis. Tell us about it.
Well, I think that especially now, let's be clear, we're talking about the industrial or commercial IoT here. And when you look at why companies are going with an IoT looking architecture, it really is all about the analysis. I mean, yes, they do want to control things, but the thing that really separates basic industrial process control from the industrial IoT is the analysis piece. And, I think this was beginning to happen in a really strong way by the beginning of the year. And by the time we got to some of the mid-year conferences like Sapphire and the big Oracle conference, this is what everybody was talking about.
Right. Now, this very much closely ties into Chibert's prediction for IoT when he thought it was going to be one of the things that MVNOs are going to be pushing. And I had the same concerns. I said, look, I see the promise. I've talked about the promise. I would love to implement the promise of IoT, but I thought the security concerns were going to mean that even though it gets the lion's share of press, you're going to have some of the bigger companies still relying on more traditional data rather than IoT data. So what's our call on 6 months? Because this was the short term. Lou, let's start with you.
You know, I saw some adaptions with, you know, especially AWS and Azure being adapting to the IoT platforms that they had. And later in the year, you saw AWS come out with additional support, especially on security and provisioning of your systems. And so I think that, again, it's almost a push. I would say probably didn't get it because, again, people didn't focus on it in the beginning of the year, probably, again, because of a lot of the security violations and issues that we were seeing. So I would say no.
And Chibert?
Yeah, it got pushed out to end of the year. The tools were there, but people were scared because of all the things that happened with IoT devices. And, you know, to be fair, those IoT devices were really badly designed.
Yes, they were. Well, I mean, they were all devices that were network devices, but they weren't ever really designed to be put out on the public internet, which was the scary part. And Curtis, I'm absolutely of the same mind, which is just like the last two, the prediction was right. It was the time frame that was off. And, the reason why the time frame was off was because it did get so much steam. It got so much press. It got a lot of attention. It looked like it was ready to go. And then they started getting all the security cases rolling in, and enterprises just, they slammed the brakes. So I'm going to say it was the right prediction, wrong time frame. Are we all okay with that? Curtis, yeah. Want to make another push for?
Well, at least I'm in good company. What can I say?
Indeed. And oh, by the way, on this one, everyone said yes, and I said no. I think that was the pattern. I think there was always one outlier. All right, let's go to Lou. So your very first prediction ever as part of the Twyatt hosting crew was about HTTPS. Tell us about it.
So it was more around, people moving to the kind of the direct connect, the express route. So like if you have an on-premise organization, you want to build some cloud infrastructure, data centers in the cloud, and you wanted that kind of secure connection that's a little bit different than VPN, that your service provider might allow you to do this concept of what they call direct connect, or I think Azure's version of it is express route. And the idea here is it allows you to interconnect your on-premise sites with some of the cloud-based data centers with high bandwidth, really low latency. And, you know, I guess this is kind of an unfair prediction because you don't really know when corporations are adapting this because they kind of do it without telling anybody.
Right.
So the only way you're going to really know is if you see kind of the adaption rates. And you'll start to see there was some public information around, like in the UK data centers, they were using express route with PSN connectivity, moving things for private connections for, you know, UK data centers there. You start to see a little bit more about some governments doing it. But again, I wouldn't say that it was fully adapted as I had hoped, because again, I was thinking that corporations were going to start trusting the cloud a little bit more and move off their on-premise world that they have. But I don't think it has moved as I'd hoped, as fast as I had hoped. So I think the adaption rate was much lower, and especially in the first 6 months.
Yeah, I think so. I think the adaption rate was a little bit low, but I will say that you're right. This is one of those difficult ones to call because they don't tell us. Nobody wants us to peek into the data center, so we can't really know. We have gotten a little bit of confirmation from things like the zero rating. In the zero rating cases, we do get a little bit of peek inside of ISPs, data centers, and colos, and I am seeing it there. What do you think, Cheever? Can we call it? I mean, there was definitely a move. We didn't quantify how much of it had to move, but I think Lou was definitely right about the trend, even within the first 6 months.
Actually, I want to give it to them just because I've been hearing a lot from the folks at Citrix.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And VDI is, while it never really took off, having a direct connect is a lot more happening than I thought it would be. You know, we saw that with Awingu. We saw that with Ericom. And we're definitely starting to see it with Citrix. So I'm of the opinion of giving it to Lou because I am starting to see a pretty big change on Direct Connect.
Yeah. And that's, again, it's one of these where we called the trend. I just, you know, did we get the time frame? I think we did. Curtis, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to be the contrary voice on this one because I think it's very, very company specific. Last year, I ended up talking to a lot of companies. And it was funny because there seemed to be like a 50-50 split between those who were telling me how proud they were that they were going away from commodity internet to something like an MPLS, leased line in the old parlance, where they were doing this direct connect, not going out over the internet. And they would say that, you know, they like the stability, they like the performance, they like, you know, the security, all these good things. About the same number would come to me and say, you know, we want to tell you about this great thing we've done where we've ripped out all of our MPLS service, replaced it with commodity internet. And it depended heavily on a couple of things. One is exactly where in the world they were doing it. Right. Because in a lot of cases, the MPLS, the private direct connect, is just an order of magnitude more expensive than the commodity internet connections. And that matters. The other one wasn't so much the cost of the service, but the amount of time it took to have it installed. I heard over and over that when you needed to set up an office, when you needed to set up a branch, when you needed to expand things, you could call a local cable company, a local telco, say, I need DSL, I need a cable modem, I need something. And within about 48 hours, you were up and running. In many of the same cases, when they called their MPLS provider, they were looking at a 2 to 4 month installation window. And the way that business is moving, the kind of speed we're talking about, that is just a deal breaker in a lot of cases. So I'm going to be the contrary voice and say that for a lot of reasons, while, yes, there's been some movement in the direction of this, there's been just about as much movement away.
I like that. Actually, that's a really, really good case. I hate to say this, but I think it's another push. Because Lou voted against his own prediction. Dang it, Lou. Why would you do that? That's just contrarian, that is. Well, gentlemen, that's all we got, because unfortunately our 2016 predictions episode was slightly interrupted. So we had to stop with the short term. And I think what we can say is we got it right, kind of. Go figure. When we come back, let's go ahead and jump into the 2017 predictions. We all have our short term, our mid term, and our long term, and I think we're running out of time again, so let's really try to push through these. But first, let's take a moment to thank another sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, look, I get it. Deployments are really hard, especially in an era where development cycles can run days instead of months and years. I mean, we expect things to happen faster, and we expect there to be no downtime, which can be really problematic for that IT admin who's working with limited resources. Wouldn't it be nice if you had a tool that could help you see through these deployments, to plan when you're going to need to deploy certain software updates to this side and that side, when you get to see the development as a more complete cycle rather than individual crucial deadlines? Well, thankfully, we've got that in GoCD. Now, GoCD is an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks that can soothe your deployment headaches. GoCD gives you the ability to model complex workflows across multiple teams with comprehensive pipeline modeling. With GoCD, you can model both parallel and sequential execution. What does this mean? Well, in a word, it means visibility. Their value stream map lets you track a change from commit to deploy at a glance. You get a complete picture of deployments across your organization so that you can be agile in your response and see issues before they become problems. GoCD also offers complete customization for your software's individual needs. It can perform tests written in most languages or frameworks with detailed logging, telling you exactly which change set and on which platform a test started breaking. All of this adds up to you saying goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. GoCD is the best continuous integration and deployment tool that you've probably never heard of. To learn more about GoCD and for a free download, visit gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. All right, gentlemen, we've used up most of our time, but let's see how much of this we can get through. Chibert, as before, let's start with you. What's your short-term prognostication for 2017?
This one's actually a fast one because it's already starting to happen. Smart TVs get smarter with the integration of things like Raspberry Pis and Android starting to already appear in smart TVs. This kind of platform popularity may mean that VDI as a service from large ISPs might be able to start happening in the near future. So when we go to that website, you're actually going to see one of the things that already started to appear, and that's Amazon Workspaces. And heck, you know, being able to have a desktop, not have to maintain it, and be able to access a desktop from anywhere in the world is a pretty compelling argument. And there's been a lot of argument about this on and off for many, many years. I think it might actually start happening. Of course, from the blip we had about people closing big data centers, I'm now starting to waffle.
Okay. Now, here's the thing. I absolutely believe in this. I think we are heading there. I believe it's a very cool solution. I am not convinced by the time frame. I don't think it's going to happen in 6 months because we were talking about VDI 3 years ago, and it's still just kind of creeping across. Chibert, tell me, what would be your measure for success? Where would you say, yes, we've hit that critical mass, or yes, this is the point at which I think we'll get in 6 months?
I think it's going to be when someone like CenturyLink or Comcast or, you know, one of the big residential or consumer ISPs starts offering data, video, voice, managed desktop. Ooh. I think that's going to be the telling point.
I like that. That's very specific. Okay, gentlemen, so that's our task. Within 6 months, and yes, that started last month, not this month. So by the end of June, we're going to see a major service provider, be it Comcast, Cox, whatever it's going to be, offer that bundle. And in that bundle, we're going to see desktop. So Chibert says yes. Curtis, what about you?
My only hesitation is the time. Mm. I think it's an aggressive timeline. I'm in an optimistic mood. Why not?
Okay, yes, all right.
Yes on this.
Lou, what about you?
So, I'll be honest with you, with the adaption of some of these other operating systems like WebOS 3.0 from LG and some of these other ones, they do offer this capability. There are apps you can add that give you the ability to do almost like a remote desktop VNC type thing. But I think I kind of agree with Curtis. It's a timing thing. So I would say that I don't think in the first 6 months. I don't think so. But I think it's gonna come close. I think there's gonna be some provider that's gonna start doing that, and that's what business is gonna jump to. But I don't think it's gonna be in the first 6 months.
Okay, and I'm actually with you. I T-Bird, I think you're right. I think we're gonna see it. I don't think it's gonna happen in the first 6 months. But we will say this right now: if any major provider offers desktop any across the United States, then yes, you got it. Can we?
That has to be residential.
Residential, right?
Needs to be residential.
So a residential provider offers a bundle, or actually, we won't even put the bundle stipulation. Offers desktop in any form as a service, then you get it. Cool.
Cool.
All right. Let's go to the next one. So let's do mine. Actually, this is. I'm pretty sure I'm going to vote against myself as well. I'm thinking that within 6 months, we will see an example of wearable devices that actually become useful. We saw so much promise about how wearable devices were going to give us continuous monitoring, and they were going to give us so many data points that the enterprise would be jumping over themselves to incorporate it into their offerings that never really materialized. We see so much wearable technology that it looks cool, but it ends up in a drawer, or it ends up that we continue to use it, but it's not really providing any data to anyone except us. I think that's going to change within 6 months. And here's follow my reasoning. The one that's going to change at the category is the medical wearables. There's two companies right now that are doing fantastic things. The first one is Medtronic. They're working with Fitbit to make a constant blood sugar monitor, and PH Vitality, which is a French company that we saw at CES, and they've made a connected device that can do constant glucose monitoring without any pain of a pinprick. I mean, it does, but it doesn't hit the subcutaneous layer. The nerve layer, so it doesn't cause any pain. So you can check your blood sugar as many times as you want during the day, and you don't feel anything. All for less than the cost of testing strips. We all know how big of a problem diabetes is here in this country. I think the money is there, and that's what's going to finally force it. You're going to have customers who realize that a constant monitoring solution is so much better for their health and so much better for their doctor's knowledge that you're finally going to find a couple of companies that say, yeah, this should be it. And they're supposed to release in second quarter of 2016, which is why I'm okay with saying this is a short-term and not a year-long prediction. Chibert, what do you think?
I'm type 2 diabetic. I want it to happen. So I'm going to say yes just because I want it to happen.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually, Brian Burnett here in the studio, he's the same way. He's a type 1 diabetic. And he said, I just want it. I mean, this is the first piece of technology that I've actually wanted to use because it will make my life better without a doubt. Lou, what about it?
Yeah, I think you're on spot. I've actually been to some local, maker fairs and some of the research facilities around the area. And a lot of them are doing, especially medical, like you were saying, they're adapting. G Medical especially is doing a lot of these things as well. And I think you're right. I think they're on the precipice of getting to that point where people are going to start using them and the people are going to want them more and more because they know the technology is there.
Yep.
So I'm going to give you a yes.
Yeah, thanks. And what about it, Curtis?
I'm going to go ahead and say yes for a couple of reasons. The first is, again, I want the medical side. I also am type 2. My son is a type 1 diabetic. I see the kind of devices he wears. He has to wear a pair of devices. Yeah. One is the CGM, or constant glucose monitor, on one side of his body, the insulin pump on the other. If he could somehow spare himself a cannula stick every week, yeah, I think that would be a wonderful thing. The other reason I'm going to say yes is, I'm wearing an Apple Watch Series 2. I have been since the holidays, and I have been frankly stunned at how rapidly it has become an important part of my computing ecosystem. I now use it as the primary way that I get text messages, one of the main ways in which I get social media messages and even work email. I take phone calls on my watch. They really are becoming useful in their own right. And as you say, we're probably just one good killer app away from a major surge in them.
Right. I mean, because after that first rush of so much promise and then so little delivery, the money is there. We know the money is there. I mean, we look at Apple, we know the money is there. All that it's going to take is one business, one enterprise finally comes through with that breakthrough device, and you have an insurance company who says, oh, right, yeah, we're going to pay for this because this is going to save us money with our customers in the long run. And suddenly, all of that promise about wearable tech becomes real. All right, so we're all unanimous on that, and we're probably all going to be disappointed. I bet it's not going to happen in 6 months. Oh, well, we'll move on. Curtis, what about you?
Well, mine is a little bit more prosaic. I think that what we're going to see is some significant changes in machine learning and the impact they have on network security and application configuration. You know, you can use a lot of words to describe humans, and in the context of computing, slow is a good choice of those words. The need for rapid response in virtualization and intelligence threats means we're going to trust systems to do their own configuration on a millisecond by millisecond basis. This is going to change the way we think about system configuration and the jobs that have been filled by experts in system setup and configuration. Machine learning is something that I'm already starting to see companies talk about in security, in analytics, and in infrastructure as a service. I think that we are right there at the cusp of this becoming the way things are done in more cases than not, rather than just a cutting edge or even bleeding edge kind of application.
Got it. Okay, so for you, what would be the case of success? At the end of June, what's the thing that you would point at and say, this happened, therefore my prediction is right?
I tell you, I think that if we see one of the truly huge infrastructure vendors come out with machine learning as a key feature, and by one of the really bigs, I'm talking Cisco, Juniper, that category of vendor. We start seeing it there rather than just in the security software side of things, and I think I would call it a success.
Okay. How about this? Could we narrow down the number of vendors it could be? So, of course, Cisco, HP, who else? Who else would you consider a big enough vendor to say it's now mainstream?
Good question. Like I said, I they're going to be slow, but I would say Juniper has to go in there. Would we throw Dell into that category doing?
Dell should be in there.
So that gives us four. I would bow to Chebert. If he's got another one, then I would bow to his expertise.
Chebert, do you think anyone else should be on the list?
Personally, I think it's just any of the blue chips.
Okay, yeah, actually, that's an easier way to say any blue chip. So if any blue chip adopts this, your prediction is right. Let me put that in there because we're going to forget that. Okay, gentlemen, what do you think? Let's go around the horn. Chebert?
Maybe.
There is no maybe.
No, I don't think so. I think it's going to be second half of the year.
Okay. And personally, I'm actually the same way. I like the promise. I think it might actually not even be in 2017. I think this is a longer prediction, so I'm gonna say no. But yeah, just like before, I think it's all about time frame. What about it, Lou?
Either Curtis has an Einstein-Rosen bridge somewhere, or he knows somebody inside. Because I actually think that this is going to come in the first 6 months because there are like they were saying, the blue chips companies, they're already doing something like this where they're starting to analyze trends and pulling in analytics to generate learning curves on how people are going to attack their network and securing their network and how do they could change the way their network is actually based off of that data. And I think it's going to actually happen. I think, and in fact, it's probably already happening, which is why I'm pretty sure that it's going to happen the first 6 months.
Okay. I like this. So this is two on two. Cheebert, I think we can take them. if it happens within the first six months of the year, I think Cheebert and I owe the two of you a beer. And if it doesn't happen in the first 6 months, I think the two of you, I don't drink beer. How about pizza? Can we go for pizza?
We can do pizza.
Let's do pizza.
Let's do that. Okay. New York pizza. I'll fly it to you.
And I tell you what, I can even, if we're all going to be someplace like Black Hat or DEF CON, I would do it there.
All right. That's a date. We will either have pizza or beer. Go figure.
Cool.
Yeah. All right, Lou, you've got your short term.
Yes. So it's almost like a marketing thing, but it's augmented reality has been kind of like a gaming thing up until now. And people were talking about how, I think somebody had some predictions previously around, hey, I think it's going to actually come into fruition. I think it's finally going to become a thing. And I think that I'm not talking about like the adaption of more Pokemon Go enhancements or Xbox gaming. I'm talking about like some part of the industries and enterprise that are going to pull it in and they're going to embrace it and they're going to do something with it. And that part of the industry that I think is going to be is marketing. I think that the marketing teams to be able to sell brands and do other things, sell products, they're going to pull in augmented AR to fully embrace and have people experience in their current world. So, the whole idea of putting AR virtual reality glasses on might be a little daunting, but augmented reality is going to help. And I think that in the first 6 months, we're starting to see this, with Google's doing it, and there's, again, you have GE, Target's actually moving to it, potentially Best Buy. So I think, these worlds are trying to think, hey, big box stores are going down the toilet. Let's find another way for people to experience these things potentially in their own home. How can we do that? And so I think that's augmented reality is going to be the thing.
Okay. So again, it's got to be the same question. What triggers a win? What do you think is the event? What's the thing that you're going to point to in 6 months and say, see, I got this?
I would say the adaption of it from some of the big box stores, like some of the big stores, maybe Amazon or something like where they start to actually implement it so you can experience things. Because I said it from a marketing perspective. So I'd say any large chain of a corporation or retailer in the United States, if they start to adapt it.
Okay, I got that. Cheebert, what about you?
I think it's going to happen. So I'm wearing a new pair of glasses from Glasses USA, and I got to upload a headshot and try the glasses on virtually. I think someone like Glasses USA is going to have a mobile app where you can use selfie mode and try on glasses virtually. I think that's going to happen. I think it's going to happen within the first 6 months.
All right. I like that. I'm going to say... Yes. And I think the reason why I'm going to say yes is because I'm already seeing the move into the blue box. Some of the press releases I've been getting have been talking about how like Lowe's was actually very happy with what they did with Microsoft's AR product. You've got Home Depot who has been sending out feelers saying, how easy would it be for us to do this? And people generally like it when they try an AR experience. They go, okay, I get this. Maybe not something that they would buy themselves, but something that could definitely be useful inside of a retail or home improvement environment. So, yeah, I'll give it a yes. What about you, Curtis?
I think I'm going to go ahead and give it a yes as well. And I think it's really interesting, the example that you chose, the Lowe's Home Depot, because in a lot of ways that actually leverages some of the industrial augmented reality applications that are already in the field, where you see augmented reality used by field service technicians on things like fighter jets and military aircraft of various sorts, using them in this hands-on industrial or semi-industrial setting makes a ton of sense The bones are already there for the applications to work. So I think it's going to happen, and I think you're spot on as to where it's going to happen.
Indeed. Gentlemen, that gives us our short-term predictions. Let me rewind the tape really quickly. So T-Bird had the prediction of smart TVs eventually integrating VDI, or the VDI platform being eventually a consumer thing. And his win would be if a major provider of residential service bundles VDI or puts VDI in its service option. T-Bird said it was going to happen. Curtis said it was going to happen. Lou and I both said it's not going to happen within 6 months. The second prediction was mine. I said that wearable devices are actually going to be useful in the first 6 months. All of us actually said yes, so that's kind of strange that we all agreed. Curtis's was that machine learning would be integrated into a blue chip product. We've got two no's and two yeses. Brian and I said no. Curtis and Lou said yes. And we were unanimous on Lou's prediction that within 6 months, we're going to see one of these big box stores that are going to be using augmented reality. Are we all good with that? Can we go on the record?
Sounds like a plan.
Okay. Sounds like a plan.
I'm going to call an audible. I know that we have more predictions, but we did run out of time. Go figure. You know, it seems that we always have things to talk about. I'm going to call an audible. What I'm going to say is let's come back in 6 months. We'll be able to check these predictions, see how they did, and then we're going to offer our second half of the year predictions. Does that sound better? Actually, that sounds more manageable than trying to do one set every year.
That's good, yeah.
I think that's a good idea.
Yep. All right, gentlemen. So there we have it. The die is cast, and at stake, beer and pizza. Could there be anything better for the romance of enterprise networking? Go figure. Gentlemen, this has been so much fun. I love doing this when we're all on at the same time. I know we can't do it every week because we do have guests, but there's something special about having the four gentlemen who care the most about the Twiat Riot. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, we'll get around to that. But first, I got to talk to the people out there because, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 psychics who can see into the future and tell us whether or not we're right. I want to thank my co-hosts. I wouldn't do this show without them. They're the ones who just make this so much fun for me each and every single week. Lou, let's start with you. Where can people find you? Where is your work going to be popping up?
Well, you can always find me at twitter.com/LouMM. And also all of my work, especially the Outlook Mobile. If you don't use Outlook Mobile today, check it out. The new CRM or Dynamics 365 app just released yesterday, add-in to allow you to kind of integrate CRM with your Outlook Mobile. So it's kind of a cool thing. And they have other things on there as well as, you know, OneDrive and some other things, some integrations as well. So check that out. And you can always check all my work at crm.dynamics.com.
Fantastic. And Curtis, what about you? Where can we find you when you're not giving us your Twiat mind?
Well, Padre, the easiest way to find me on a regular basis is on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA. My work appears at Light Reading. And if anybody from the Twiat Riot is going to be at RSA, look me up. I'll be there all week. I would look forward to meeting some of the Twiat folks out there, getting your feelings about what's important in the world of security.
Curtis Franklin, always a pleasure. And of course, my friend, Brian Chi. Chibert, I heard this rumor that you're going to be playing around with the NASA folks.
Yeah, actually, by the time this episode airs, I will have been out at Kaneohe Marine Corps Air Station and seeing some of the new oceanographic and geologic scanning aircraft that NASA has to offer. It's going to be a great press event, and I'm hoping to be able to share a whole bunch of snaps.
Are they going to be exploring that beautiful lava, what do you even call it, lava faucet that they had on Kilauea?
Unfortunately, the lava faucet has collapsed, and
no!
It almost took some tourists with them.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There's a whole bunch of people beyond the ropes.
Don't they have like 50,000 signs telling people, hey, you're going to die?
Oh, yeah. Hey, better yet, there are lava tour boats right below it, right in the path of the toxic
cloud of gas. So,
yeah, oh don't boy. You get like sulfuric acid fumes coming off of lava
and sulfur and this yeah. and that, all kinds of nasty stuff. Anyway, find me on Twitter at ADVNETLAB, and I'd love to hear what you want to see on Twiet in the future.
Indeed, because remember, folks, T-Bert is our super producer. He's the man who books the guests. He's the man who sets our agenda. If you want to see something, if there's a problem that you're having in your job, if there's a solution that you think we need to be taking a look at, he's the man to contact. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. Yeah, of course, we also need to thank the other people, the people who watch Twiet every single week. We wouldn't have a show without them. We want to make it easier for them to get the show. They can go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiet. That's T-W-I-E-T. There they'll find all of our episodes. And my goodness, we're up to episode, 226, which is kind of ridiculous. We've been on this train for quite a while. And, if you're going to watch, why not subscribe? If you subscribe on those little menus on the side there, it means that you can automatically get the version of your choice into the device of your choice. Every week, every time you release an episode, you can have the audio version in your phone. You can have a video version in your tablet. You can have the high definition version on your laptop or your desktop so you can watch us in HD goodness at home. And believe me, I look good in HD. I really don't. Anyways, it's all there, twit.tv/Twiet. Also, don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter. Go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. Follow me, and you'll see what I'm doing when I'm not in the Twit TV studios. Most of the time, it's soldering things and setting things on fire accidentally. But, you know, again, twitter.com/PadreSJ. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo for letting us do This Week in Enterprise Tech for all these years, to the engineers who allow us to run the show, and to my TD today, this wonderful, wonderful person. She's actually, I've really grown fond of her, and it's going to be so sad when I have to kill her. Kara Cole.
What are you implying? When I leave? When?
Kara, could you tell the folks where they can find you?
Oh, you can find me. Well, it's kind of hard to find me. Actually, I'm behind the scenes a lot here on the Twit Network, but I produce the screensavers. I TD a lot. I'm one of the studio engineers. I do camera operating. So you might get a sneak peek of me behind the scenes occasionally. And you can follow me on Twitter if you want, at Kara080.
And more likely than not, if you ever see me crying, it was because of something Kara said to me.
Yep.
Yeah, that's how that works. Folks, until next time, I am Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiet.